Ivy Farm is a cultivated meat company based in the UK. They make real beef from animal cells without the need for slaughter. Their mission is to help build a sustainable, ethical and scalable food system that can meet the world's growing demand for protein without compromising the planet. Riley Jackson is the head of brand and strategy at Ivy Farm, helping to shape how consumers understand and connect with cultivated meat, which is a big part of the journey for cultivated proteins. Listen to her story and how they fully expect to bring Ivy Farm beef to market by next year. I'm Alex Crisp and welcome to another episode of Future of Foods Interviews. You can subscribe to all future and past episodes for free on Substack and on other podcast platforms. So welcome, Riley Jackson, to this episode of Future of Foods Interviews. Riley, you are at Ivy Farms, which is a cultivated meat company based in Oxford. So if you could just kind of give me a little background about you and your role there at Ivy Farms and what drew you to the world of cultivated meat.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat. So I am kind of a career alternative protein gal. I discovered it back in university. I was studying business and sustainability, and I found that when I was talking about the food system and eating plant-based at the start, it was the first time I really felt empowered as an individual to make change for the climate change movement. I saw the potential of it to change a lot of people's lives, from health to their environment to animal welfare. And I was just like, wow, like this is it for me. I really love this. And it just lit me up to talk about. So thank God I've found a way to get paid to talk about it, which is incredible. So Ivy Farm, I found my way to after lots of time in the plant-based space. So I've worked for companies like Impossible Foods and Tyndall Chicken. I first cut my teeth in the space working on the Beyond Meat launch into Canada with A&W from the advertising side. And that was absolutely fascinating. And I think for anybody who's not in the space, one of the most interesting things is how differently everybody reacts to food systems disruption. So I've talked to butchers, I've talked to farmers, I've talked to tech bros. So they all have something different to say. And it's really, really fun. I was drawn to Ivy Farm because one of our fearless leaders asked me to come over and work on the brand and marketing side for them as they approached commercialization. And I think cultivated meat as an idea always absolutely fascinated me, but I was at a level that I couldn't really get into the space back in university. So plant-based is the route I went. And I think the cross-section of really incredible, innovative technology with complete food systems disruption is such an interesting, challenging communication project. So I absolutely couldn't say no. So I moved from sunny California to the lovely Cotswolds, and here I am.
Okay. Well, I mean, it is a fascinating area. I mean, the consumer, I suppose, hasn't really been asked the question yet about cultivated meat. So I mean, what is your strategy, I suppose, in regard to engaging the consumer? Have you sort of come up with one?
Yeah, so I've been doing a lot of research lately on consumer perceptions in and around cultivated meat. There are some studies that are specifically about cultivated and then others that are kind of tangential. So obviously the ones that are about cultivated meat are interesting because asking a consumer about a product they've never seen or tried is still good information, but it's asking somebody what it's like to walk on the moon and would they do it again without being able to. So taking that with a grain of salt, I've also been comparing our journey to non-alcoholic beverages that are typically alcoholic, or the organic movement, the plant-based movement, and learning from how consumers feel about something they deeply love being changed. And I think pulling from those has been fascinating because a lot of similar themes come up, right? People want naturalness with their food, they want transparency with their food. Above all else, far and away is taste. Of course, we know that something has to taste incredible for people to want it. Convenience is really high up there. And naturalness, I think I'll come back to that one because that one puzzled me. Just because of the way we eat today, there's so much unnaturalness that isn't necessarily a bad thing. Of course, the greener the better. But I think our constant pursuit of purity and naturalness, it means something so different to everyone. It's like saying what's healthy, right? So I think our approach has very much been test and learn. And it's been let's partner up with really incredible companies and organizations that want the food system to change for the better and want to launch really interesting, fascinating products that people will love and gather that information. Because if I learned anything in the plant-based space, is there's always going to be someone that is so excited and someone that is infuriated with what you're doing. And so I think you have to really just push through, test and learn, stumble, fall down, get up, keep going at it. And luckily, this space is full of people that are extremely resilient because they believe in what we're doing. So I think the long answer, the long and the short of it really is that it's impossible to really know what people are going to do until they have the product in their hands. So building a web of educated guesses is really the approach right now.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's the question is how much, or the question possibly is how much should the consumer know? About it, how much should we be informing them? I suppose if we were to compare it to meat now, the consumer knows very little about how the meat gets to their plates. I mean, if they really knew what was happening with their meats in the abattoirs and stuff, they might not be so keen to eat it. And maybe it's might be a similar thing with cultivated meat. Maybe the kind of less they know, the better.
Well, I mean, I think that's one thing that's really interesting is our process is incredibly clean and precise, right? It's really what I think you would want, or at least for myself and the people that I know, the attention to detail, the meticulousness, with which we produce our product. If any contaminant gets into the system, the entire batch doesn't work. So we know the second something happens, the second it changes, the second something's off, and we pivot, right? Where you're seeing entire zoonotic diseases wipe out all of the eggs in the US. And I don't know quite enough about that to comment on it, but I think the disconnect of this is normal because I'm used to it versus this is a good system is pretty stark when you point it out. I really love, and this might be an unpopular opinion, I really love the ultra processed movement right now because what it says to me is, while a lot of it is a little bit fanatical and a little bit hysterical, like a high energy, I think it's a great sign that people are getting really curious about what's in their food, where it comes from, who is making it, why it is the way it is. And I think that to me is a signal of I want to know what's going into my body. I care about it and I'm going to learn about it, hopefully. But trying to educate someone on what cultivated meat is while also pointing out the ups and downs of the meat industry is too big of a challenge. So I'm choosing to educate on the cultivated meat. And then let them go on their own educational journey with the rest of their food choices.
Yes. So how would you describe Ivy Farm's broader mission than what is the cultivated meat they're producing? Is it chicken?
It's beef. So
Beef.
we make Angus and Wagyu beef. And Our co-founders met at Oxford University, and one of them, Russ Tucker, was from a family of butchers that goes back. And one thing that he loved about his upbringing was how responsible and kind his family was about the animals. There was a responsibility to treat others as you want to be treated, to say it simply, and that extended to animals and the way they did business. And he grew up to be a very successful consultant and traveled the world and worked for these huge grocery chains, retailers, and n really discovered, like we were just talking about, what it takes to have a food system that turns animals into food, and what that means for everyone involved. And he was like, "There's got to be a better way." He's a very, very brilliant man, so he was like, "Let's invent a technology that does this and make it work." So we're foundationally aimed at supplementing factory farming so that we no longer need to have such aggressively, I don't want to say toxic, but such aggressively caustic processes that really contribute to deforestation and water pollution and all these different things that we could go on and on about, and I'm sure you're very aware of. But he was like, "Let's make sure that the smallhold farmers, the family farms, can still do what they need to do and produce premium whole cuts and this incredible meat, support their communities, give back to their communities, be part of the nation versus the meat that we're importing from abroad that has lower welfare standards and is burning precious rainforests, let's say, in order for us to have our minced beef at McDonald's." So that's foundationally who we are. And I think as a company where we differ from a lot of others that have come before us is a really aggressive, low-cost model, and keeping our capital expenditure low, focusing really aggressively on the science, making sure that's great and scalable, and then slowly building up our capacity to produce over time before we build anything big. So
And
making
how,
sure that we can get to the end result.
yeah, and how close are you now to commercialization?
Yeah, well, isn't that the golden question? So it really depends on regulatory approval, right? Like we could today probably supply a couple restaurants in the Oxfordshire area, but it's all about where we can sell and when that happens. So we are scaling up internally, of course, so that we can produce as much as possible when that time comes. I would guess it will be mid to late 2026, hopefully sooner. But we're very, very close. And I think having been in this industry for a while, and I'm sure you can relate, being able to see the product and have chefs come in and make dishes that we can all look at is incredible. And something we've been waiting for a very long time. To use that moon analogy from earlier, it's kind of like seeing the rocket that you've been using blueprints to describe for 10 years. It's incredibly exciting.
So
So it feels close.
mid to late 2026, is this when you expect to get regulatory approval, or is this when you expect to get food on the shelves?
So hopefully they'll be very close to each other. So regulatory approval, of course, has got to come first, and the regulatory bodies we work with are working extremely diligently to make it happen. But hopefully we'll be able to get on menus at least very quickly after we have regulatory approval, because basically what we're doing right now is building that infrastructure and that backbone so that we can just launch when we get the green light.
So
Doing something. Oh, go ahead.
Ivy Farms is part of the FSA sandbox scheme, aren't they?
We're actually part of the advisory committee for it, but we're not actually in the sandbox itself.
And they said when was it they said it was it April they said it? No, it wasn't. It was a few months ago. They said it'll take 2 years, didn't they? But from to sort of go through the sandbox scheme. And I'm assuming that means it'll be 2 years before anybody gets regulatory approval. So, yeah.
Yeah, so the people that are in that are all in various stages of the approval process. So for us, we're quite a bit further along. So we're not tying ourselves to that timeline. The sandbox itself is meant to streamline the process and co-educate so those companies can learn from the regulators and vice versa, so that the UK can build a really robust food innovation pipeline, which I think is incredible and very future-minded, so that when companies come up in the future, they can get to market faster. And I think that's really the point of it.
Okay, so that doesn't necessarily mean that nobody will be given regulatory approval for 2 years. You think that perhaps it will come sooner.
I'm hopeful. Yeah, so it's hard to know, to be honest. But I'm hopeful that that is the case. Yeah.
Okay, well, that is quite exciting, isn't
Yeah.
it? Ivy Farms, I assume you've applied for regulatory approval in more than places than the UK, though.
Yes. Yeah, so Singapore and the US are also in our dossier submissions.
Ah, the US. How is that going in the USA?
Honestly, pretty well. I mean, I think all of us in the industry were cautiously optimistic with everything that's been happening. I think it's cooking along as much as it has in the past. And with the Mission Barns approval earlier this year, I think we were all really excited about that, especially since they make cultivated pork fat, for anybody who doesn't know, out of San Francisco. Really incredible team. And they really quickly launched in Sprouts, which is a retailer that's always been a champion of alternative proteins. And then Fiorella, I'm going to pronounce it incorrectly, but it is an Italian restaurant in San Francisco proper as well. So I think, like you were talking about earlier, with that quick turnaround of approval to on shelf, I think it's a great way to say, hey, look at this incredible thing we did. Go out and try it. Because I think consumers don't get the chance to make it a reality in their head. It's this concept. And it's a really simple thing, right? We're just making muscle and fat. It's just in a very different way. So I think as soon as people get to interact with it, they'll be like, oh, okay, this makes sense.
So, and
But
so you're going for the full cut, meat.
So we make the building blocks of muscle and fat ourselves. So we don't actually make any of the connective tissue like most cultivated companies. Some people go for a 3D printed model or a scaffold model where you grow the cells adhering to a surface of some kind. For us, that's not quite scalable enough for the volumes that we want in order to make an impact. So right now we're focusing on getting actually quite creative with the products we make. So I've seen everything from your classic meatball burger, to a puff pastry inclusion and a gravy inclusion, and we're looking at all sorts of different things. And the wonderful thing about it is how versatile the product is, because it isn't a whole cut. While I'd love to see the most incredible juicy Wagyu steak, I think what we're trying to circumvent, like we said earlier, is factory farming. And typically, you're not going to get a decadent, delicious filet mignon from a factory farm, right? So that's not really what we're trying to circumvent. Well, it is going to be a premium product. It's going to be something that is probably a little bit surprising to people. Like, we will do the minced beef and the burger, but we also could do soups. We could do all sorts of things. So I think, like, if you look at Vow, for example, what they're doing, I think in Singapore there's a menu where they have a cultivated quail parfait. It's called a quail walks into a bar. It's really cool if you haven't looked it up. Very fun. And then they have a martini that's called a quail walks into a martini. And so it just kind of goes to show you there's so many different things that all these incredible culinary minds can come up with. And that's been one of the most fun things lately is bringing in chef partners to tell us what they would do. It's really, really cool.
I mean,
Stay tuned.
clearly at this stage, I guess the kind of first Mark One cultivated meat products are ingredients. So, lots of companies are doing fats and kind of various forms of that. Because, I mean, clearly scaling up is a problem, isn't it? And to make the fats is easier to scale up. You don't need the scaffolding. You don't, and 3D printing is incredibly expensive, and you would need huge 3D printers to make this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So So fats are the way forward, and your product is kind of a version of that. It's not fats exactly, it's kind of something along those lines, is it?
Yeah, so we're doing fat and muscle cells, so we're not differentiating, whereas some companies are differentiating, and it takes a little bit longer actually to do that, from what I understand. And again, I am head of brand and marketing, so I don't go into the lab that much,
Yeah,
but I
exactly.
know what they're doing down there. So from what I understand, a lot of the companies that are choosing to differentiate are a little bit further behind in terms of volume. But again, I think it's a great idea, and if you look at the meat shelf, there are thousands of SKUs, thousands of different product opportunities and options for people to get exactly what they want. And I think that's what alternatives need to provide. Like, we need to have all sorts of different solutions so that people are happy and can make a delicious choice that's also better for people and planet. So I hope all of it works, but we're doing muscle and fat.
Yeah, I mean, so clearly the name Ivy Farm is a very
Wholesome.
wholesome name. Yes, it is, isn't it? And there's a few companies that have used farm in their title, like Aleph Farm, and I think there are others. So, how important is language in this whole thing? I mean, calling it cultivated versus lab grown, for example, in your brand strategy. How, I'm coming back to you as a marketing person, away from the sort of science elements of it. So how important is language?
I mean, I think it's everything, honestly. The cultivated versus lab grown debate has raged on. One thing, of course, from the data, from asking customers and consumers, everybody likes cultivated more. It sounds better. It's a beautiful word. And it's actually more descriptive for what the process will be, because if you think about how most food is created, it starts off in R&D, right? I mean, unless it's an apple, and most apples also are engineered. So, anyway, all that is to say, a lot of stuff starts out in an R&D lab or passes through a lab to get tested for contaminants, things like that. So, labs are a really important part of our food system, but they're not where product is created in mass. It's not a production facility. So when we scale up, we're not going to be using anything that's pharmaceutical grade. We're going to be using food grade, like any other food company. So we're actually not going to be lab grown. We're going to be manufacturing grown, or like we'll be manufactured. So it'll look a lot more like an Anheuser-Busch brewery than it will a Pfizer facility, right? So
And
for obviously branding and for consumer acceptance, I'd like it to be cultivated, but lab grown also has much more of a title catching, attention grabbing
Yeah.
weight to it.
I mean, officially, I think GFI officially came out and said we are all now calling it cultivated. So everybody's aligned with that. But I wonder what might happen in some European countries. They are arguing that we can't call it meat. I wonder whether in the companies you have come up with an alternative if you're no longer allowed to call it meat.
I'm not honestly sweating about that because it is meat, so I just don't think that will get pushed through, because we're not misleading anyone. Whereas, like, I'm so biased with this because I think it's hilarious that you would assume consumers can't read a package. However, I think that it's important to be descriptive, and we're happy to say cell cultivated, we're happy to say cultivated, we're happy to describe it on pack. But I think consumers are really intelligent and they know what they're doing. And because we are genetically identical to meat and we are meat, I'm not super concerned about that. I also think, to be wildly honest with you, I think that by the time we have the scale to be in grocery stores in mass, people will know way more about cultivated meat, and it'll be much less of a contentious topic than it is today, right? People just don't know what it is yet. And so I think like Italy banning it, the states banning it before it's even there for consumers to try and decide for themselves, I just don't think it'll stand. It's not constitutional.
Right.
So I probably should be more worried than I am, but I kind of am, I'm letting the chips fall with that. And I know that our target areas, like let's say California versus Alabama, I'm much happier to focus on California.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I stand with that. Maybe controversial, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly, at this stage, the markets, in regard to those who are not. Who are not banning it are large enough for it to get started because it's such a new product. So I mean, what are the sort of key concerns do you think consumers might have for cultivated meats? What do you think are the biggest hurdles? I mean, do you think the information or sort of misinformation or kind of media, the media approach to it is going to be a problem?
Isn't it always? I hope not, but I think like anything that's new and disruptive, there will be a little bit of clickbait happening. And I think the less people know about it, the more hysterical they will be. Because again, I've never had a conversation with somebody where I describe to them what we do and they feel worse after. It's always like, oh, okay, that's not what I thought. So I think familiarity is incredibly important with anything, right? Especially with meat, right? It's a very base form of culture for some, like their self-image, their sexuality, their family life, holidays. It's a central part of their life, right? Most people eat it every day. So somebody coming in and saying, that's bad, don't do it. And you're going to do this now, and it's something you've never heard of and don't understand. I totally get why that's threatening. So our approach to it has very much been, hey, we're making this really incredible product. And if you want to learn more, here's more information. But the amount of info you give has to be just enough at the right time for someone to actually hear it. And want to have that conversation. So what's coming up in the research I'm doing right now, like that research we were speaking about earlier, is a lot of people, of course, taste and price are by far and away the key indicators of whether or not a product will thrive or die. Those are really important, specifically with cultivated meat, familiarity, naturalness, transparency, and authenticity. Those are really important. Convenience. Can I put it into my diet right now as a one for one? Those are the things that are coming up. And what I hear from that is education. People need to know what they're actually going to be buying and what it actually is. And right now, we don't have enough, sadly, enough scale, any of us, to do tastings all the time and stand in a booth and say, hey, this is really decadent, incredible Wagyu. Have it on a truffle cracker and tell me what you think. So I think when we start being able to do that, you're going to see a major shift, which will be wild.
I mean, I think as a product, meat is quite unique in a way because it's kind of, I don't think it can be compared to regular products like, like a car or something because it's such a part of our culture, but it's also something that we're all sort of slightly kind of disgusted with as well, because it's kind of a dirty secret that we do as human beings. It's like, we sort of kill things and eat them, and we've been doing it for thousands of years, so just kind of deal with it and let's not talk about it
Normalized.
too much. It's been normalized. And so introducing something new, it's quite a difficult concept because are we saying this is the same as the disgusting thing that you've been doing for these thousands of years? Or is this a completely new thing that isn't even It's not even meat. It's well, it is meat, obviously, but it's not like a living animal that we've been killing. Is it just a whole new concept?
Well, and I think disgust is something that I've seen come up in a lot of research as well around all different types of food, but specifically meat. I like the phrase "the dirty little secret." I think, for example, when I have friends over and we make chicken breasts, if we're doing a barbecue and I have my plant-based patties and they're doing chicken breast, they're really like, "Oh, make sure you boil everything and don't touch this." And they're scared of the contamination. And I think it's really interesting because then a half an hour later, they're biting into a juicy chicken burger. And I don't blame them. This is what they know. But I just think it's an interesting kind of, I don't know what the phrasing is, I'm forgetting it now, but it's, oh, cognitive dissonance, I think, right? Where you've built kind of a separation in your brain. And so from my perspective as a branding person in this space, I'm not going to go after trying to close that gap for them. I'm going to say, yeah, have your chicken, but maybe once a week supplement with a plant-based or cultivated and like see what you think. Because there is some merit to some diversity in your diet, and there are some things that many people, millennial and Gen Z, really care about their impact. As that grows, there's going to be searching for alternatives, and I think the natural pivot there will happen. And I want us to be ready with an incredible product that isn't a compromise when that happens. So that's kind of my job is I'm not going to fight that fight. There are incredible people trying to do that. I'm going to be one of the solutions when people are ready to hear it. I'm going to be there with a really incredible first trial so that they're into it from the get-go. That's kind of the goal.
I mean, you talked earlier about education, about educating the consumer. And it kind of makes me think of this story somebody told me, I can't remember who it was, about pizza as an example. And there was a pizza company that tried to make healthy pizza, and they said that it sort of tasted the same, but they had said healthy pizza, and on the box they said it was sort of less fat and da 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 da. And the sales were awful, you know. Nobody was interested in buying healthy pizza. And I kind of wonder, you know, the more you ed I mean, do consumers want to be educated, or do they just want to be kind of told, eat this? So, I mean, I it's kind of a, you know, the more you sort of tell them also about sustainability and the environment and health, they kind of just think, look, I'm just here to do my shopping. I just want to buy something I can eat. I don't want a lesson. I don't want to be lectured to. So in a way, they don't want to be educated. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, and I think it's so, and this is one of my favorite parts of my job. When you're thinking about sitting down for a piece of pizza, I'm not thinking about my health. I'm like, heck yeah, let me bite into this delicious, heavenly thing. And I know that I'm gonna feel kind of bad later, but in that moment, I'm sitting around with my friends, we're having a piece of pizza, and that's what I'm looking for. I think to tell another story in tandem with yours, I saw this really interesting post the other day that was about smoking. And the headline was, "Don't tell me not to smoke, I already know." And I think anybody who's been in this space has had the conversation where they're like, "Don't be a crazy vegan. Like, don't tell me what to eat. I understand that meat is bad. I don't care." And I always have been fascinated. It's just like smoking, where I'm like, wow, if you know that it's not XYZ, it doesn't match with your goals. Why are you doing it? And you never get anywhere by saying, like, by the shaming and the blaming, right? So when you're telling a smoker stop smoking, when their doctor's like, this is going to kill you, they're like, but it isn't until it becomes inconvenient to do it. And you can't smoke in the airport. You can't smoke in the plane. You can't smoke in the restaurant. You have to go outside of work to smoke. It's not until it becomes inconvenient for you to make that choice that you will pivot. And that's the human brain. We're wired for efficiency, right? So if something is a hurdle, we don't want to do it. I genuinely believe that the way the food system is going, solutions like this will be more convenient in the long run than environmentally caustic factory farming. I just believe that. And so I think when people are like, in this industry, it can be easy to be like, this may never work. What if it doesn't work? Are we going to be okay? It has to work because we can't do the farming that we're doing now forever. We just quite simply don't have enough land. And antibiotic resistance is going to be a thing and all these other things. So I honestly think it's just like, don't tell someone not to smoke, make it hard for them to do so. Don't tell someone not to eat factory farmed meat, make it hard for them to do so. And I would go even further and say, make it decadent and delicious for them to make a different choice and lead with that first, which with Wagyu beef isn't that hard because it is incredibly delicious. And I'm obviously biased, so wait and try it for yourselves. But for example, when we make, we're doing a lot of plant-based blends right now just to see, can we add anything to these blends? The most incredible thing is when you bite into, let's say, a soy meat alternative, right? One of the big ones on the shelves. The aftertaste of soy is pretty, like you taste it, you're like, this is a good meaty product, but I know it's not meat. When you add in 20% Wagyu beef, 10% Wagyu beef, that goes away. The aftertaste is gone, which I think coming from the space, of course, blew my mind. And I was like, wow. So all those people that are like, don't really like the taste, can't really get on board. I want to make that choice. My dad's a great example from the Deep South, will not give up burgers. And I think genuinely, if this was an item on shelf for him, he'd be like, yeah, I don't have to compromise. It's better for me and the planet. Sure. Same price. Great. Let me grab it. It's got to be downhill. It's got to be downhill.
Well, it seems that I spoke to Meatable, Jeff Trevisan, and he was saying that to imagine like a burger where they've taken away 25% of the farmed meat and they've replaced it with cultivated. And nobody will know the difference. Nobody would kind of tell that there's anything strange about it. And that will replace 25% of factory farming with something else. And so that's, so I suppose early stage at least, it's going to be a kind of additive, but more of a kind of main ingredient. Is that how you see it going? So I mean also. I heard somewhere someone calling it new meat, which I thought it's a good, you know, because I suppose when you call it cultivated meat, you are reminding people that it's different, that it's strange, that it's unusual. If you just call it new meat, it has a level of ambiguity about it, I think, which might kind of satisfy human shoppers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting idea. And I know at the early days, the Paul Shapiro book, Clean Meat, at that time, they were calling it clean meat. And I think while it does sound better, undoubtedly. I think transparency and authenticity are going to be the name of the game with this. And if you look at any disruptive technology, anything from converting from horses to cars or gas to electricity or river ice to artificial ice, people freaked out every single time. Freaked out and said, this is the end of civilization. This is going to poison everybody. We're not on board. No. But the innovation was better, it was safer, it was easy, and eventually cheaper. Right?
I mean, it's about cost, really, isn't it?
100%. Yeah. So if we taste great and the cost is low, I think people will get used to cultivated. And this could be naivete, I have no idea. But my guess, and kind of having done what I've done, my guess is if we do truly stack up, people will get on board.
And you've tasted it yourself, I assume.
Yeah, in a tasting session internally for product development, I have got to try it.
I suppose it's a little bit of, I mean, I've spoken to a few people who have I haven't tasted it myself yet.
Oh, not yet.
Not yet, no. Maybe Hoxton Labs, Hoxton Farms.
Yeah, in London, they're incredible. Yeah, great group.
But I suppose there's a little bit of an anticlimax when you taste it because you kind of expect something new, but the whole point of it is that it tastes the same, right? So
Yeah.
yeah, that tastes the same as chicken, or that tastes the same as beef.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on the level of inclusion, right? Because many companies are going to market with a 3% inclusion. And I think all progress is good progress, but you do want to wow and you do want to, again, lean into taste, right? So if for us internally, if we add 20% of our Wagyu to something, it's very decadent, very, very decadent, very meaty, very rich. And it, honestly, some of the plant-based people are like, this is overwhelming. I can't do it. And the meat people are like, ooh, yeah. So it's really interesting. And so I think like you'll see different SKUs, right? Like you'll have some companies that are like, we're adding in 10% of pork fat to plant-based bacon and it's going to sizzle and have that umami. But we're not going to go any deeper because our target demo is plant people. Whereas like for us, we're going to be like meat eaters, come have like Wagyu popcorn and it'll be, you know, it'll be all sorts of different things. But if they want a plant-based steak and we want to marble in our fat and our muscle tissue, it'll be delicious and it'll be
Wagyu
decadent.
popcorn, is that something you have considered?
We're considering everything. I keep it really open, but my product team is going to kill me for saying that because we're not sure if we can like dust or spray yet. But I think again, it's like any new product, we're exploring every avenue. We
Interesting.
probably won't do Wagyu popcorn. That's very selfish because I desperately love popcorn and that's what I want. But you see like beef chips, right? And so if we're going down the premium route, like premium snacks, huge, huge market.
So you mentioned earlier that you'd done some research, some kind of some market and consumer research.
Yeah.
Have you seen any responses that have surprised you from your research?
Honestly, what surprised me is how consistent the information was. I thought that Singapore versus the US versus Europe, we're going to be really different, right? Because it's such different consumer groups. The approach to meat is very similar across the board. And the reaction to, honestly, the only thing that really differed aggressively was the reaction to plant-based and what kind of products people lean into. Because obviously, in Singapore, for example, the adventurousness of the palate is much higher than the UK, for example. So they're willing to have a quail martini, whereas in the UK, people are like, "Are you okay? We're not going to be doing that."
Well, I'm not so sure
So,
about that. I mean, it sounds a bit unusual. I mean, fine, I
yeah.
lived in the Far East for 5 years and I tried some strange things, but no, a quail martini sounds a bit.
Well, and again, though, what's really interesting, and I could talk about this all day, so I won't, but let me go down this slight tangent. What's really interesting is if you look at like the adoption curve of any product, right? Early innovator, early adopter, early majority, majority, late majority, all of those customer groups are so different. So like you and I are not the target demo for a quail martini, but early innovators are like, I'm traveling to get that because I want to say I've tried it. And that's a totally different market. And that's the market at the beginning, right? And those are the people that are influential and out there lining up for the iPhone, for example. And then we'll get into kind of more mass market stuff, but we need to test and learn. And Vow is absolutely leading the way with that kind of stuff because they're not afraid of a challenge. They're not afraid of novelty, as we've seen. For better or worse, there has to be that initial first mover that pushes the boundaries because there is no getting around that this is very new and very different and very technical, but also quite simple, right? Cell replication is the most natural process, arguably, in the world. It's happening in all of us all the time. And turning that into something that we talk about when people don't want to talk about meat is hard. So it's going to be bumpy. It just is. But those martini people are not going to be the majority, right? But they'll hear about cultivated through executions like that. So it's an interesting balance. And there really is no right or wrong way in theory. But It's really fun to watch people's reactions to that stuff.
It is a very interesting scientific and cultural sort of development. I mean, I suppose the reason it's the reason I've got into it. I mean, I believe that it's kind of it's going to be quite an important evolutionary step for mankind to start kind of producing its food in this way, and I think it'll impact in on our behavior in lots of ways. You know, as soon as we sort of take slaughter out of our food system, maybe we'll become kind of kinder as people. That's kind of how I've seen it, you know, even if just partially.
Well, and I think that's kind of the whole concept that we touched on a bit earlier is I don't think anybody really wants to kill anything.
No.
Like, I think at the end of the day, we all love a juicy, delicious piece of meat, but some of us are uncomfortable enough with the sourcing of that product that we don't do it. And I think everybody that I know, it's just like smoking, right? Like, nobody is like, oh, yeah, I'm so glad I smoke. Like, yeah. And
Yeah.
probably people aren't like, I'm so glad that I have to kill something in order to eat this steak. I think there's varying levels of comfort, but if people have a genuinely good product that is as at price parity, as good health matchup, I genuinely believe that people will be excited about that. And it
Yeah.
won't be everybody all at once. Like, we'll have to work at it and educate and talk about it. But it starts here with things like this, where we're able to have conversations that curious people can look at and dive in as they want to.
It's with everything. There comes a tipping point. You know, when enough people start doing it, everybody else will follow. And I suppose that kind of comes back to what you were saying earlier about the kind of early adopters versus these sort of stragglers that kind of follow what everybody else is doing. And it's
Yeah.
and that happened with smoking. I mean, now most people don't smoke because they'd be standing on their own smoking, and they'd feel quite sort of self-conscious about that. So
Yeah.
it's very exciting. What's the most exciting, you know, finally, before I let you go, what's the most exciting thing that you foresee over the next 12 months or so for Ivy Farms?
Yeah, gosh, I think it's going to be a wild next 12 months, to be honest. Probably the most wild yet. I say that every year, and it's true every year. But I think for us as a company, the collaborations we have lined up, the partnerships, and the brain power those provide in our product development, our scale up, I think that's going to be a complete unlock. And I think personally, getting to work with globally renowned chefs and restaurant groups, and seeing how excited they are and creative and game just to kind of get it going and say they can. Chefs are really fun to work with. It's very different than scientists. So it's really incredible to see. Really, everything right now is gathering information, right? We're an R&D. We're gathering info. We're marketing to consumers. We're gathering info. It's all about building, building, building that foundation. And then when we launch, it'll be the springboard, right? So I think the amount of new personalities, new hires, new partnerships that we have coming in the door is just gonna show us completely new perspectives that will change what we do. And I think that is really motivating and inspiring for a lot of reasons.
So are you well funded now then until commercialization?
I don't think any startup would ever say it's funded enough.
Yeah.
Probably. We have a really wonderful, committed family fund in Europe that is in this for the legacy and for the impact and for the business case, right?
Yeah.
So we're not worried, we're not sweating, but of course, all investment is welcome.
You have one major kind of
group.
backer, right? Who are they? Are you allowed to say who they are?
It's a private fund, yeah, so I'm not allowed to say
Yeah.
no.
Is your ambition, final question, I promise,
No, that's okay.
is your ambition to be the first in the UK to get regulatory approval for human consumption?
That would be ideal. That would be lovely. I think it's I'm going to be excited, as we all will be, the moment anybody gets regulatory approval for humans. I think we all would like to be first, and everybody has worked so hard for years. We've been around since 2019 doing this. So I think I would love to see the work of all the scientists here come to fruition. I think that would be an incredible day, and to be first would be very meaningful as well. So fingers crossed, we'll
What's
see.
the chance of you being first then, do you think?
Oh man, I mean, it's hard to know, honestly. It depends on so many different variables, so I couldn't speculate.
And there are a few other people in line, like Aliphant, like Hoxton, and various other.
I'm just hoping anybody gets approval in 2026. I think entering into the market next year would be a huge accomplishment, and I will be on this on the cheering side of whoever's up there.
But it's certainly not 2025, then, you think?
I would be shocked. I pleasantly, it would be a very nice day, lots of champagne. But I don't think so. We'll let Meatly cook along with their plant-based inclusion snacks for pets right now. That's enough of an accomplishment for us for 2025.
All right, great. Well, Riley, I look forward to seeing you at the conference in October
Absolutely.
in Amsterdam. And thank you for coming on to the Future of Foods interviews. It's been wonderful talking to you, and I'll be following with great interest the developments of Ivy Farm.
Yay.
Thank you very
Thank you.
much.
Wonderful. I'll see you soon. Have a good one.